Okay, there. Good evening, everyone. Here at the Zendo, out there in the Zoom realm, wherever you are, whatever the weather is where you are. It's beautiful, beautiful winter wonderland out where we live this morning. Even a little more fresh snow, another layer of fresh snow. So this is week four of our series, the two more to go after this, our series on a text called 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva by the 14th century Tibetan master Tokme Tsongpo. And I'd really recommend this commentary, translation and commentary by the American teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, Ken MacLeod. These verses, these 37 verses, are in the Tibetan tradition of Lojong teachings. Lojong meaning mind training, I think. I don't know Tibetan at all. but that they're straightforward instructions in verse form, very accessible for ordinary people. And there are many different sets of Lojong teachings in the Tibetan tradition. I almost get the impression it's sort of a rite of passage to write one's own set. But this is one set that's survived and has become quite revered. And they're in kind of list form, ways to train the mind to release the harmful habit patterns of thought, speech, and action that we all have, and to cultivate beneficial ways of being in this very difficult world. Ways that lead to deep freedom for ourselves and for others. So these Lojong teachings seem to be, you know, at first glance, fairly simply presented, simple language. But they actually offer a lifetime of practice, of increasing depth the more you do these practices. So the first sequence, just as a little review, offers guidance for establishing a reliable foundation of practice, for understanding that our being is impermanent, ever-changing, and that we don't exist as a separate self apart from that web of dynamic interrelationship with everything. And to realize furthermore that our suffering and our dissatisfaction arise from our ignorance of those deep realities. Our stubborn habit patterns of wanting things to be different, wanting what we want and not wanting what we don't want. And Tokme Tsongpo encourages us to rely on the stillness of Zazen to maintain clarity of mind and to build confidence in our practice. Always coming back to that stillness and presence. So from that foundation, then, he moves to the practice of Tonglen that Michael introduced and talked about a bit last week. Tonglen meaning taking in and sending out as a way to meet and respond to the suffering around us and within us in our everyday lives. And when we do Tonglen as a meditative practice, we first ground ourselves in the breath, in the body, And we invoke our aspiration to awaken for the benefit of all. And then we bring to mind someone who is suffering in some way. And we visualize breathing in their pain and suffering and breathing out comfort, healing, and light. Which when we first encounter this practice seems really counterintuitive because of course we, you know, and there are healing practices of breathing in what's of benefit in breathing out the nasty stuff. We want to breathe out, you know, we want to get rid of the nasty stuff, right? But this is the opposite of that, and it doesn't mean that we are taking in and incorporating that pain, that suffering. We are transforming it. We are accepting, embracing it, and then turning and giving forth what's healing, what's light and easeful. So then these verses give us some pretty challenging situations to work with, as you may remember, those of you who were here last week. We are asked to respond to situations like having all our possessions stolen, or other ways that we experience being stolen from, like our work or our creative ideas. You know, how does that feel? I don't know if anybody's ever had that kind of experience, but, you know, when someone else takes credit for all your hard work, you know. Or being slandered or publicly humiliated, these kinds of experiences. And we are being asked to respond not with retaliation or hatred, but with an open, caring heart. Seeing that person who we see as causing us harm, seeing that person as with respect and care, as someone who has offered us a teaching. This is not easy practice, is it? We are asked to see the suffering that gave rise to that person's behavior, to see that person as a suffering being, to take in their suffering and to send out healing and ease and freedom and clarity of mind to them. Now, sometimes that's, when we're in the grip of painful feelings, that's almost too hard a shift to make. So we have to first attend to our own state of hurt or anger or fear that's evoked by whatever this experience is. And then we do that taking and sending for ourselves. We take in that particular kind of pain and suffering that we are experiencing, and when we do it, we also include everyone else, with a sense of almost kinship, everyone else who right now is experiencing something very suffering very similarly. So we stop, we pause and think of everyone else who has just such a miserable, abusive boss, or a mother who just doesn't see who we are, or, you know, whatever it is, or a difficult spouse right now, or a terrible loss. Everyone else who's experienced a similar terrible loss that we felt, and we include them and take in their suffering. And, you know, that sounds like, oh, that would be too overwhelming. And yet when I've done that, it opens my heart. It takes that contracted self-focus and opens it up in a remarkable way. And then we breathe out ease, healing, comfort. Now you may feel, if you read the language of these verses, that it sets the bar too high. You think, oh, I couldn't turn around and praise someone who has just criticized me so harshly, huh? What? I think the language in the verses is purposely somewhat extreme to disrupt our usual habit patterns, assuming that our habit patterns are self-focused, which mostly they are. So I would like to encourage you, as you engage with these traditional verses, to actually write them in your own language. This is not like some divine sacred text from above. This is a text for us to use and adapt to the 21st century. So give these words that are meaningful to you. Pick one that, and we'll come back to this, that somehow speaks to you. And write it in your own words. Let's look at some more. Let's pick up where we left off last week, and that would be with verse 16. And these are more examples of the way we human beings hurt each other. Verse 16 says, "Even if a person you have cared for as your own child treats you as her worst enemy, lavish her with loving attention like a mother caring for her ill child. This is the practice of a bodhisattva." Well, that's a tough one, isn't it? I don't know, maybe some of you may have had the experience of raising an adolescent, of seeing your sweet, funny 8 to 10-year-old turn into a snarling, disdainful adolescent. I mean, that's not guaranteed, but it does happen, right? And it hurts. It hurts to have your sweet kid looking, you know, demonizing you. I have not had that experience personally, but I've, you know, heard reports of how painful that is. You know, if you've had any experience like that, and it's not necessarily parent-child, it can happen between friends or spouses, you know how hard it is to stay calm and grounded and remain the adult in the room when your own reactivity is triggered, when they're, whoever that is, your child or your spouse, is pushing all your buttons. If you're on the receiving end, it's so easy to feel unjustly accused or disrespected. And yet, this verse is asking us not to take it personally, to touch into our caring heart, what Dogen Zenji calls grandmother mind. Now, that doesn't mean you have to go on a love offensive, declaring to your oppositional child, "I'm just saying this because I love you." Right? That's probably not going to work. Whether it's your oppositional child, your oppositional spouse or work colleague, the practice of listening is invaluable in these situations, meeting the person right where they are and doing the work in our practice to build the capacity to take a step back, not escalate an explosive situation, and regulate ourselves. And to know ourselves well, to know what our buttons are, our trigger buttons, our vulnerable tender places, you know, places that we ourselves have been hurt. So we attend to that. We practice with that. Let's look at the next verse. 17. "Even if your peers or those below you put you down to make themselves look better, treat them respectfully as you would your teacher. Put them above you. This is the practice of a bodhisattva." So this verse deals with that kind of competitive mind, always comparing, that is so rampant in our society. And there's so many different variations on this theme. When the verse says, "put them above you," I don't think it means to debase yourself. You and the other person are equally worthy of respect. What it means is to let go of that self-focused sense of victimhood and to see the insecurity and grasping in the other person, to see their suffering and your own, and to take that in and send out care and acceptance with deep insight into the conditioning, the generations of conditioning that give rise to these habit patterns of one-upmanship and comparing. You know, we learn these things. We learn it in childhood. And then it's reinforced. It's reinforced by our culture. Next verse, 18. "When you are down and out, held in contempt, desperately ill and emotionally crazed, don't lose heart. Take into you the suffering and negativity of all beings. this is the practice of the Bodhisattva. So here's where he's saying, even when you are most miserable, you know, and those times do come, with the support of your practice, you can open that up to the sense of kinship with other beings suffering from some of the same causes and conditions, in other words, the human condition, that you are. And you can, in again, be careful don't to set the bar so high that you feel, I can't do this. Even a little bit of soft heart softening makes a difference. You know, we can do practices of Tonglen and also of loving kindness and compassion, the Brahma Viharas practices that we've talked about before. We can do them in the context of our meditation practice, when we're supported by the Sangha and the you know, particularly when we're in retreat, we can go more deeply because we are more stable. But we can also do what I call street Tonglen or street metta, street loving kindness. You know, right there riding the bus or passing someone that is in obvious suffering, we can pause and we can take three breaths. Or we ourselves are activated by some fear or anger or whatever, we can pause, we can take three breaths and consciously shift it, open it, even a little bit. So in the next verse, he turns it around and he cautions us not to be complacent when things are going well. Even when you are famous, honored by all, even as rich as the god of wealth himself, know that success is ephemeral and don't let it go to your head. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So, in our culture, which worships status and achievement, we need to keep our practice steady through the ups and downs of perceived success and failure. You know, not to just be crushed with some little failing on our part, or to get too excited by the praise when it comes, or the success when it comes. The next verse is both a really vitally important one and also a little problematic in its wording. If you don't subdue the enemy inside, your own anger, the more enemies you subdue outside, the more that come. Muster the forces of loving kindness and compassion and subdue your own mind. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So this language of the subduing the enemy is fairly common in Tibetan or esoteric Buddhism, and it's used metaphorically, of course, and in that stream of Buddhism, there are often images of fierce deities wielding swords, sometimes fangs, and really fearsome, to depict a kind of fierce cutting through delusion, fierce determination. But we also, I think, maybe need to realize that some of these images arose from cultures of militarism and were designed to communicate to young monks who were raised in those cultures, and that it doesn't work for all of us. Especially in our world today, where there is so much suffering caused by warfare, both the overt warfare of weapons and the more subtle kinds of enmity and warfare. So the trouble with this kind of language, I feel, is that it can reinforce a kind of harsh self-judgment, self-hatred of I need to subdue myself. And that doesn't support opening our hearts to ourselves or others. We know from experience that when we or someone else are in the grip of a strong anger reaction, you know, that where our fight, flight, or freeze response to threat is activated, if it's the fight response, or the flight response, or the freeze response, they override our higher functions of good judgment and care for others. So it's not so much a matter of subduing that threat response, but staying present with it, pausing, not react, unless, of course, it is a matter of a car running a red light and you're in the crosswalk and you need to jump away. But in the more non-life-threatening situations, to be able to stay present, allow that reaction to arise and to subside, to summon up kindness and patience and compassion and make space for a wider view. And these are all capacities that we build over years of practice. We fail and fail again, and then we keep practicing. Ken MacLeod offers a really good commentary on this verse and good counsel. He says, if you take this advice of this verse literally, you're going to stay... Oh, he says, welcome... anger. He says, welcome to hell, one of the hot hells, to be precise. There's hot hells and cold... Cold hells are the freeze reaction. Hot hells is anger. And he says, if you take this advice literally, you are going to stay in hell. When you wage war on anger, even with the forces of loving kindness and compassion, you are still waging war. A war on hell means you are in hell. War is not the way out. So he's pretty unequivocal about this. And then he said he offers three basic ways to work with anger or other strong emotional states. Dissolve, employ, or transform. And so what these mean, to dissolve is to experience without expressing or repressing, to allow a rising and then a subsiding. So it kind of dissolves just by that holding presence. As though you are, you know, a loving, caring parent holding the child through a fright or a tantrum or a state, just in that careful way, with tenderness and patience. That's the dissolve. The second one, employ, is referring to that Tonglen practice of employing that state arising to do the practice to use it as a practice, yeah. To take it up and employ that experience as a practice. And then the third one, to transform, is actually the transforming is to have an arising of an intense state, whether it be anger or fear or others, and to penetrate directly into its, we could say emptiness, right? And when we say emptiness, we mean conditioned and impermanent nature of that arising. So we see directly into it, and in that direct seeing, we let it go. So it's a kind of, it's actually the most difficult way. And sometimes we can do that. We can turn it just like that. We see it, and we turn it, and it's gone. So dissolving is that presence, that spacious presence of allowing and arising and passing. Employing is actively engaging with that state in a heart practice of Tonglen. It could also be the Brahmaviharas, practices of loving kindness or compassion. And transforming is seeing directly into the nature of this conditioned arising. So being able to notice those three options sometimes helps us kind of in the moment make a choice. You know, I'm gonna take that step back. I'm not just gonna lash back out, or in the case of anger. We could say a lot more about anger, but moving on, the next four verses address kind of the ultimate insubstantiality of both what we desire and what we want to avoid. That they are conditioned, and our desires and our aversions are conditioned and transient, impermanent. So I'm just going to read all four of these in a row so you get a sense of them. Sensual pleasures are like salty water. The deeper you drink, the thirstier you become. Any object that you attach to right away, let it go. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. That was 21, 22. Whatever arises in experience is your own mind. Mind itself is free of any conceptual limitations. Know that and don't entertain subject-object fixations. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. When you come across something you enjoy, though beautiful to experience, like a summer rainbow, don't take it as real. Let go of attachment. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. All forms of suffering are like dreaming that your child has died. Taking confusion as real wears you out. When you run into misfortune, look at it as confusion. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So this, all these are saying, basically, is whether we desire and savor a person or a pizza or praise, whether we dread and grieve the loss of someone we love or our reputation or our wallet, it will all change, and our reactions are conditioned. But, warning, please don't tell someone who has just lost their own child, which is, you know, pretty much the most devastating loss one can face. Don't tell them it's just a dream or an illusion. They might get just as mad at you as the mother I once knew whose Christian pastor told her that God wanted her daughter up in heaven. And she told me that she wanted to punch him, but she wanted to snap. What she wanted to snap back and say is, "Yeah, well, I want her here. I want her back here." Our job is not to deny deep grief or other emotional states that we'd rather not deal with, but to cultivate the capacity to let them arise and shift and pass within this kind of compassionate awareness of the human condition And our kinship with others all over the world. I had a very minor experience of this just the other day. So those of you who may know, the reason that I, as a Zen priest, have this long hair is because at the beginning of the pandemic, my mom, who was 96, died of COVID on the other side of the country, and I couldn't go. And so I said, and we weren't going anywhere anyway, right? We were all locked down. And so I said, okay, I'm not going to cut my hair. I can't. Like in some traditional countries, the cultures, women would cut their hair, shave their head, but mine was already short. So I said, I'm not going to cut it. I'm not going to cut my hair until the pandemic is over, in connection with all those who lost loved ones and couldn't be there. Right? Little did I know, 3 years later, that I'd be getting really annoyed with this hair that keeps falling out, and it's brittle, and my hair's all over, and clogging up the vacuum cleaner, and the pandemic's still not over. And and then I read this article about hair loss during the pandemic, and that women have a significantly higher rate, that there's been increased hair loss, and that women have a significantly higher rate of hair loss through the pandemic. And I just went, Oh, all these women taking care of people, and when their kids are at home, and they're working in the care homes, and their hair's falling out, and they're trying to keep the Zendo going. And I just had this all these women all over the world, their hair's falling out during the pandemic. And it completely shifted my feeling of annoyance with my hair. And then I thought, okay, it's still going. So that's just a little example. It's a little example how we can turn it, open it. What's called confusion in this translation can also easily be called delusion, and the delusion is our stubborn refusal to see the truth of impermanence and no separate self. I think that using that word illusion isn't always that helpful. It's not that all that arises and passes in our lives is unreal, it's that reality is not what we think it is. When we deeply understand that the reality we live is simultaneously the reality of everyday life, of particularity, of distinctions, and the reality of utmost unity and interconnection, when we deeply experience and know that, then it's not so hard to let go of our clinging and our aversion. And we can simply respond to changing circumstances of life with as much wisdom and compassion and appropriate means as we can. So I think we have to be careful not to think that non-attachment means not caring. It just means that we're not swayed and buffeted by the winds of life, by what are called the eight worldly winds, the pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. That we're not just always trying to avoid one and get the other. Because ultimately there is nothing we can hold on to or control, but we can make small choices in how we will live in this world, how we will meet each moment. And making those small choices requires practice, remembering over and over and over to pay attention. And that's simply what these verses of Lojong or mind training support us to do, to remember to pay attention. So I think we have a little time. What I'd like to invite you to do in small groups, as we usually do, is actually find a verse that particularly just sparks your attention, and put it in words, put it in your own words. So take a few moments, or if that's hard, you know, I know for the Zoom people that's a little harder because you don't have the text unless you opened it up from the website. Or just talk about one that is just really particularly relevant for you right now in your life and how you might practice with that. Okay? But it also, if you want, if you're feeling like, you could also do this at home if you want to write your own. But if you can just now, take a look, and then we'll divide into groups. Okay?